Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 207 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm, or subscribe to the podcast using iTunes or other programs. Listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990. And speaking of phones, PRN.fm has voicemail, so call 862-800-6805 and make sure you note that the message is for The Infectious Myth. How about a little bit of feedback? Barry on Twitter wrote, "Thanks for following me back. I love the podcast. Keep up the great work." Bridget on Facebook, in reference to the Megan Murphy interview regarding the conflict between feminist and transgender activists, "The interview is great. It's how I learned about your site. It is a very taboo subject to discuss unless you are just on one side. I appreciate your coverage." Roger on Facebook talked about Peter Gotchi and the scandal over the Cochrane Institute. "I so want to get on side, but why did Peter Gotchi refuse to discuss his endorsement of AZT as a useful treatment for HIV positivity back in the day?" I responded, "He's not perfect. Maybe I'll have the opportunity to ask him again. He's critiqued mammography, psychiatric drugs, HPV vaccine, which is a lot more than the zero critiques of most MDs." Mindy wrote regarding the fuss over an Italian group that independently analyzed the constituents of vaccines. "What scientist worth their salt would say there's enough testing and no more needs to be done? Many scientists dismiss the need for additional research on vaccines on the grounds that they are already rigorously tested and are flummoxed by the decision to donate to CorVelva, which did this testing on vaccines. Quote, my first reaction was bewilderment, says geneticist Gerolamo Lanfranchi of the University of Padua. I agree. If it was science, you should want questions asked. Let's get to this week's interview. George Mashke is from Long Island, New York. He spent 4 years in the U.S. Army and then did a bachelor's in Near Eastern Studies at UCLA, followed by master's and doctoral degrees in the same subject area. He currently works in The Hague, Netherlands, as a legal translator. He's co-author of the free ebook, The Lie Behind the Lie Detector, and we're going to discuss the lie detector, also known as the polygraph, today. He can be found online at georgemashke.com and antipolygraph.org. And don't worry about the spelling of his name. I'll include links in the show notes. Welcome to the show, George.
Thank you, David.
Okay, well, I think most people don't really know much about the polygraph. They've probably seen it on television shows, and they know that it's used, and, you know, they may have some questions about it. But let's start by, when was the polygraph invented? Who invented it, and what kind of evidence was used to persuade people at that time that it was useful?
So the polygraph was invented in 1921 in Berkeley, California. Of possible interest, the inventor, John Larson, was an immigrant from Canada, and he was a medical student at the University of California at Berkeley, but also a member of the Berkeley Police Department. And he had read some research earlier by William Moulton Marston, who had developed a sort of lie detector that just used a blood pressure cuff. Mm-hmm. So his idea was that you could expand on that, and he put together a device that would included a blood pressure cuff, but also pneumographic tubes that would measure a person's breathing and record these measurements on a paper chart, which is something that Marston's technique did not. He just listened to the pulse and take notes.
Right. So, okay.
So this was in 1921. Mm-hmm. And it was used in some investigations, most notably, I think the first one was of a theft at a sorority in Berkeley, California. And it had the support of the Berkeley chief of police.
Mm-hmm.
And Larson also had an assistant named Leonard Keeler, who was also an amateur magician. And it's Keeler who actually ran with the polygraph and refined the machine, making it portable and devising regular paper charts rather than with ink pens. The Larson's polygraph used what was called smoked paper, and the tracings would be scratched onto the paper.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Leonard Keeler's polygraph is the one that became adopted by police agencies in the United States and later in Canada, and he's the big person who promoted it
in
those early days.
The word polygraph, I presume, comes from the fact that it actually measures multiple things.
That's right. And more than one tracing. So there's breathing and cardio activity. It's really a strange thing, because to measure someone's blood pressure, you've got to inflate the cuff and then deflate it and take measurements as you're doing that. With a polygraph, they're using a sort of measurement that isn't used in medical science, where they just keep the cuff inflated and measure something. From it, you get the heart rate, but some tracing that appears to be related to blood pressure, but it's not really blood pressure. It's undefined.
Right.
And there's a third tracing, which is palmar sweating activity, and that's done with a couple electrodes on fingertips.
Right, and the more sweaty you are, the more conductivity you have, right?
The better it conducts, yes.
Right. Now, are these, back in the day when this first came out, you just have three separate pieces of paper if you're measuring three things. Are those integrated into like a single number nowadays, or do you still get three readouts that you have to interpret?
Okay, well, all of these readouts in the original paper paper chart-driven polygraph instruments, all the tracings would be on the same sheet of paper.
Okay.
There would be a separate pen for each tracing.
Mm-hmm.
In recent years, they've switched to computerized polygraph instruments.
Right.
So it sort of emulates the paper chart in that at one glance you can see all of the tracings. So typically there's two breathing tubes, the tubes that are put around the chest and abdomen to measure breathing. The palmar sweating or mm-hmm. galvanic skin response channel. And at the bottom you'll see the cardio channel from the blood pressure cuff.
And how do
sometimes additional tracings are added too, like they'll put a pad on the seat to see if there's any physical movement.
Okay. So, I mean, I could see with some difficulty you could try to run a scientific experiment where you tell people they're going to lie, they're going to tell the truth, and try to validate the testing. But, I mean, what was done back then? Was it just, you know, somebody who had the machine persuading the chief of police of Berkeley, or I think that's where you said it was, or was there
yes.
like an experiment set up to try to get some scientific evidence?
Well, there were some trials done, but not like double-blind peer-reviewed research like you'd expect from
mm-hmm.
a scientific journal in the early days. But the key reason that it caught on was, apart from any validity that it may have had, and by the way, it's known now, it has no validity, but people who could be persuaded that the machine could read their minds would sometimes confess. So police valued it for the confessions they got from gullible criminals who, you know, thinking that they've been caught in their lie, the best course of action for them is to confess and hope for leniency.
Interesting. So sort of a placebo effect.
Yes.
that, yes, or like right. how sometimes people are tortured by, we're going to blindfold you and we're going to put you in a box with scorpions. Actually, there's no scorpions in there, but just the thought of it is enough to freak people out.
Yes, and well, a good polygraph interrogator can convince the subject that he can see his soul. And
right. But yeah. I mean, one of the problems with confessions is false confessions. I mean, has anybody looked into that? Like, if somebody thinks that if they don't give the police a story, they're going to get beaten up, like
yeah,
the last
well,
time they
interestingly, you know, there's been there's a interrogation technique that's been taught widely to police agencies in North America. It's called the Reed technique, taught out of a school in Chicago. And interestingly, the founder of the Reed school and of this the Reed technique of interrogation is one of the key figures in polygraphy. John Reed had a polygraph school in Chicago in the 1940s, and he developed a coercive interrogation technique where the approach was to cut off any denials or any protestations of innocence by the subject, and focused on using psychological pressure techniques to get a confession with little regard for whether it was truthful or not.
The big advance of that technique, if I understand it correctly, was that it didn't involve beating people and therefore was considered more humane.
Yes, and that's one way that the polygraph was sold too, as a better alternative to physical beatings.
Right, but all of these things can cause false positives. I interviewed a guy, James Trainham, I think, who's an expert on false confessions, and he said he extracted one himself, and he didn't extract it by beating somebody, but he basically realized afterwards that he was planting the story. He was telling this person what to think, and the person eventually read it back to him, and he thought it was a confession, but it wasn't. So regarding yourself, I read on, I think at the website, do you know a guy named Jason Hubble?
Jason Hubble.
He's with a UK lie detector organization. So he wrote, in May of 1995, Mashki, yourself, was a reserve U.S. Army intelligence captain and Arabic speaker, and was administered a pre-employment polygraph by the FBI. The FBI polygraph examiner determined he was deceptive to the relevant test questions and conducted a post-test interview in an attempt to resolve the outcome of the test. Apparently for Mashki, the interview gleaned from his polygraph examination ultimately resulted in his disqualification for employment with the FBI. So is that a true story, and is that how you first became interested in the polygraph?
Except for the last part, it's true. I was disqualified based on the polygraph results alone, not on the basis of any information that I provided.
Okay.
And he lifted this from my public statement titled "Too Hot of a Potato, a Citizen Soldier's Encounter with a Polygraph," which you'll find on antipolygraph.org if you go to the personal statements page, minus the third one down. And I described that experience with the FBI in great detail.
Right. I mean, I found it interesting that the examiner would have a post-test interview to resolve the outcome of the test. I mean, did that happen? Were they saying, we're not sure about this, so we're going to talk to you?
Well, when the polygraph operator scores the charts as deceptive, he will follow up with an interrogation. It's not an interview, it's an interrogation.
Mm-hmm.
You're accused of withholding information or lying.
Mm-hmm.
And they pump you for information. Well, what was going through your mind when you answered that question?
Oh, I see. So it's a follow-up in the sense that now we know this guy's lying. What was he hiding? We can't tell from
right.
the polygraph what he was hiding. You know, if,
right.
if you're asked, probably, you know, have you ever been convicted of a criminal offense? And you know, they think you're being deceptive, then they want to find out what was the criminal offense, right? That kind of stuff?
Well, exactly. For example, with police agencies like the FBI, when you apply there, if you fail the polygraph, you're not going to get hired. And there's nothing you can say that will change that outcome. Mm-hmm. But the polygraph operators get rated on the basis of the confessions they obtain after accusing someone of lying. So they're doing these interrogations to justify their jobs.
And of course, if you refuse to give them information, that sort of helps them think, well, this guy's really deceptive because
No. If they're wrong, they don't expect a confession from someone who's told the truth.
No, I guess what I was saying is if they see something on the polygraph that makes them think you're being deceptive and you refuse to give information, I mean, does that mean that they think you're just continuing to be deceptive? I mean, let's say that they asked you, have you ever been convicted of a crime, and you say no, and they think that's a dishonest answer. And then you continue afterwards to say no. Would they think you were just being more and more deceptive?
Well, you're asking me to read someone else's mind.
Yes, okay, sorry.
Which I'm not capable of doing.
Okay.
There's nothing in their training that would lead them to believe that.
Hmm. Okay. Hubble also wrote, early polygraph training taught very little about countermeasures, except to be assured that we would know them when we saw them. The research and study that you did in your book, The Lie Behind the Lie Detector, established that this belief was in fact a misconception, that certain specific measures could be taken by a polygraph examinee that could potentially mislead the unsuspecting polygraph examiner to the wrong diagnosis. The attention Mashke has helped to focus on the countermeasure issue has had the very positive effect of inspiring the polygraph profession to aggressively tackle this concern. Countermeasures research is ongoing, examiners are being actively retrained, and new countermeasure sensors continue to be developed and fielded. So let's talk about countermeasures, and then, you know, what does this say about the polygraph? What are some of the countermeasures that you have recommended or that you have believed were?
Sure. To clarify on what you read, I suspect that this text that you're reading is not written by this fellow Howell, did you say his
Hubble.
Name?
Hubble, like the telescope.
Written by Hubble. I believe it was actually written by Don Crapole, who used to work at the Federal Polygraph School in the United States called the National Center for Credibility Assessment. And I believe that this was an article published in the American Polygraph Association magazine. They have a monthly magazine. And I believe this was published by them around the middle of the last decade. I think it's just quoted on Hubble's site without attribution. So about countermeasures, these are techniques for passing a polygraph or beating it if you're not telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And it's a fairly simple thing to do, not hard, but you do need to understand how the test works. That is, what the assumptions are that the polygraph operators are making and how they score the charts.
Okay.
So let's suppose that you're applying for a job, say, with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and because they require applicants to take a lie detector test. So one of the questions that they might ask is, did you ever commit a major crime that you haven't told me about?
Mm-hmm.
And they may understand that, you know, anyone asked an accusatory question like that, even if they're telling the truth, might show a reaction to it.
I would.
Yeah. So the polygraph operator, and this was something devised by John Reed, the Chicago guy who also developed these courts of interrogation techniques, he had the idea that, well, we could compare reactions to those relevant questions with what he called control questions. So when asking that accusatory relevant question, your reaction would be compared to a control question that is intended to elicit an emotional response from people who are telling the truth about the relevant question. So you might also be asked, in addition to, have you committed a major crime that you haven't told me about, have you ever lied to someone in a position of authority, or have you ever told a lie to get out of trouble? And it's secretly assumed that everyone has done these things, even people who haven't committed a major crime and who they'd like to hire.
Yeah, it's probably a reasonably safe assumption that everybody's lied, you know, to their parents or to a teacher or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But then the polygraph operators take it one step further, and they assume that if you are telling the truth about the relevant question, then your reaction to the control question will be stronger. But conversely, if your reaction to the relevant question is stronger, then you must be lying about it. So if you are asked, did you ever commit a major crime that you haven't told me about, and you react more strongly to that than to the question, did you ever tell a lie to get out of trouble, it's assumed that you're lying.
Right, right. Okay.
And you can see how asinine that assumption is, because it's based on nothing.
People's reaction, I mean, probably some people, if you said, have you ever lied to a position of authority, would outside of a context of a polygraph, would probably say no, right? Like, holier than thou?
That's what the polygraph operators actually want. They'll steer you into answering it no. That's the answer they want. Mm-hmm. That's why it's called a probable lie control question. They'll say, you know, we're looking only for the most honest people, and, you know, people who habitually lie or who would lie to someone in a position of authority are the type of people we don't need here at the RCMP. So if I asked you, have you ever lied to someone in a position of authority, you could answer that question no, couldn't you? So they lead the subject to answer the question no.
So they lead them into a lie, because you're thinking, okay, if I say, oh yes, I lied, but it's just because I stole, you know, cookies from my mother, so that's not really a big deal, so I'm going to say no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what happens then is, if your reaction to that control question is stronger than to the relevant question, it's assumed that you're telling the truth. And as you might surmise then, and again, this is also an asinine assumption, it's not based on any science or evidence, but it's assumed that you're telling the truth if your reactions to the control question is stronger than to the relevant question. So if you covertly augment your reaction to the control question, it makes it look like you're telling the truth to the simple-minded polygraph operator. So what you can do, for example, is to quickly solve a math problem in your head as soon as you recognize that the question being asked is a control question.
Mm-hmm.
Or another technique that's been used, this was actually used in a secret U.S. government study in 1995, where 80% of the test subjects succeeded in fooling the United States' primary counter-espionage polygraph technique. When answering the control question, they would pick a number over 600 and mentally start counting backwards by threes as fast as they could. That was all it took to beat the polygraph.
Okay, so let me get this straight. So you're asked, have you ever lied to somebody in a position of authority, and you go 693, 690, 687, and that's calming you down? So that's reducing?
No, not calming you down. You want to do that as fast as you can, silently, without moving your lips.
Right.
You want to engage in mental activity to augment, to show an increased reaction.
Subtracting by three is actually quite difficult. I always find that kind of math is kind of stressful, because you think you might get it wrong, right? Like you subtract four or two instead.
Yeah, well, and if that causes stress, so much the better, because that's the idea, is to augment reactions to the control questions, because if your reactions to the control questions are stronger than your reactions to the relevant questions, you pass the test.
Oh, okay. I've got it. And you know, it would be pretty difficult to do a you know, like you say, a double-blinded study of something like this, especially because it's based on known truth and falsehoods. I mean, let's say that you had a robbery subject and you said, well, we're just going to ask, have you ever murdered anybody? Because we'll assume, you know, he's a robber, he hasn't murdered anybody, but occasionally you'd run across somebody who had. So how could you know?
Well, for example, you wouldn't use a question, did you ever kill someone or do you ever murder someone, as a control question.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a particularly good one.
Right.
And the other thing is, in criminal investigations, you know, that you have the sample size for a scientific study of test subject, it's typically called N, but with an individual criminal investigation, N equals one, and so it's not a statistically significant sample size for any particular criminal investigation.
Okay, well, let's...
Some studies have been done, though. There's a one was done in British Columbia, actually, in a prison setting, by William Iacono, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And they set up a scenario where there was some psychological pressure put on the prisoners to do well, because I think it was they were led to believe that if they didn't perform well, there would be collective punishment for everyone.
Right.
But this was, again, still a laboratory experiment where mm-hmm. there was no real crime. And so, yes, it is difficult to come up with well-formed studies of polygraph validity and accuracy. But there's more problems than that, and key ones that prevent it from ever being a sound psychological test. Key ones being it lacks any standardization. Every polygraph interrogation is different, and it has no control within the scientific meaning of the word, because what they call control questions in polygraphy are not really any form of scientific control. And again, they're formulated specially for each polygraph interrogation after a pretest interview.
Yes. But one thing we can garner, I mean, it's not like the justice system just relies on polygraphs. So there may be cases where later, after the polygraph, it becomes very clear that somebody is guilty or innocent. So can you describe some famous cases of criminals or spies or people who passed the polygraphs and then it is later determined that they've been lying?
Yes, perhaps the most famous case in terms of spies is that of Aldrich Hazen Ames, who was a CIA officer who volunteered his services to the Soviet Union, I think in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm, I remember that case.
Yeah, and so after he started spying for the Soviet Union, and he continued spying for them after it collapsed and it was just the Russian government he was working for, he passed on two occasions CIA polygraph screening tests that were given to him. These tests are supposed to discover spies in the CIA's ranks, but they've never captured a spy through the polygraph ever. At least there's no documented instance of it. And all the cases we know were, including Rick Ames's case, where a known spy had been polygraphed, they passed.
Was he being polygraphed because they had suspicions, or is this just kind of a routine thing, like a drug test?
These were routine screenings.
Right. So with an athlete, they might say, okay, today we're doing a urine sample. You know, we don't have any suspicion. We're just going to do them at random intervals. So the CIA might say, okay, today you're doing a polygraph.
Mm-hmm. Yes. They have periodic, which are scheduled ones, typically every 5 years or so, and aperiodic ones that could happen potentially at any time. to keep people on their toes. But the thing is, it's sort of a bluff technique. The polygraph operators want people to believe that they can read their minds, and that is in fact what they purport to be doing. Lie detection is a mind reading exercise.
Yes, it is.
And none of the things that are measured by the polygraph are correlated in any systematic way with truth telling or lying. It's a pseudoscience as bad as phrenology or graphology.
Yes, I mean, one of the interesting things is that a lot of things that would show up in an episode of CSI, like hair analysis, have turned out to be much less reliable than they've been sold as. And I think even fingerprints, people are questioning.
Well, especially partial fingerprint matches, yes.
Yes, and there's been some DNA techniques that people have questioned when they have, you know, very poor DNA samples. So have there been opposite cases where somebody has failed a positive and then later being conclusively proven to be innocent? I mean, we just talked about your case. I guess I have to trust you that you would have made a good FBI agent. But are there criminal cases where somebody has been asked about a crime, they failed the polygraph, and then later other evidence has shown that they were completely innocent?
Yes, the most famous case or infamous case that comes to mind is that of Jeffrey Deskovich, who was a high schooler in New York State, who a classmate of his female was, her body was found. She had been raped and murdered. And Jeffrey was very disturbed by this and tried to help the police. He wanted to help investigate and find the killer. So the police, of course, focused their attention on him as a primary suspect.
Right.
And they got him into asked him to come to the station to help them solve the case, and asked him to take a lie detector test. And he was subjected to a harsh interrogation, totally had failed, and they extracted a confession from him.
Mm-hmm.
And on that basis of that, he was convicted of murder.
Right.
And imprisoned for almost two decades before DNA evidence led to his exoneration. He was completely innocent, and the perpetrator was identified.
So they found, they actually, yes, one of the problems with exonerating somebody is if you can't explain who did it, it's much more difficult to get people out. Like if you can find a match on the DNA with, you know, somebody who has a record of that kind of crime, then it's much easier to get somebody out. Otherwise, you just sit and rot in jail because you really don't know, who it was. You can't offer an alternative.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. When the crime is solved, that's certainly true. There was another case that's described in a book by David T. Licken, titled "A Tremor in the Blood: Uses and Abuses of the Lie Detector," of a case of a man in Ohio who was convicted on the basis of a failed polygraph test, which unusually the polygraph results were admitted at trial and was the prime evidence used to convict him.
Why do you say unusually they were admitted at trial?
Because most courts in the United States and Canada do not admit polygraph evidence at trial. But in some U.S. states, if both the prosecution and the defense agree to the admission of polygraph evidence, it can be admitted at trial. So the way this typically happens is that is that a prosecutor with a weak case will give the accused an offer, say, hey, come and take a lie detector test, and if you pass, we'll drop the charges.
Right.
But if you fail, then you have to agree that we can use the results at trial.
Oh, I see. So they kind of got you trapped at that point.
And that happened in the case of an Ohio man named Floyd Fay, and he ended up going to prison for murder. I think Ohio had, in the United States, the death penalty had just been abolished, and so he didn't get the death penalty. But he spent some years in jail before his lawyer was able to solve the crime for the police and exculpate Floyd Faye. During his time in jail, he learned how to beat the polygraph test using techniques similar to what I described to you. And he did a little jailhouse experiment because they used polygraphs in the jail to test prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that everyone he taught how to beat the polygraph passed it, including people he knew had committed infractions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another person who has tried to help people beat the polygraph is a man named Doug Williams, who got sent to jail for teaching people how to beat the polygraph. Is that mm-hmm. is that correct? Can you describe that circumstance?
Yes. Yes, I can. Doug Williams is a former police polygraph operator.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for the Oklahoma City Police Department. And he became disenchanted with polygraphy and quit his job and started speaking publicly against the polygraph. And he wrote a pamphlet called How to Sting the Polygraph, which explains techniques similar to what I described to you, basically mm-hmm. augmenting reactions to the control questions for passing it. And so he's been doing this for, well, I guess it was 40 years ago, 1979, that he started. But the U.S. government became very concerned about polygraph countermeasures and their being publicly available. And they started a undercover sting operation to try to silence people who were teaching these techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And so they first targeted a man named Chad Dixon in Indiana. And what Dixon had done was bought Doug Williams' manual, read it, and he had no experience as a polygraph operator, but just started offering training in how to fool a lie detector.
Mm-hmm.
And he got clients, and the federal government decided, well, they couldn't stand for that, and they went after him, sent undercover agents to him, and basically entrapped him for, I guess, what the key thing that they said was a crime was that when he told the undercover agents that if they were asked about receiving his training, they should say no, they didn't. They considered that as a sort of a conspiracy to lie to them in an official proceeding. Anyway, he got sentenced to, he pled guilty and was sentenced to 8 months in federal prison. Then they went after Doug Williams in short order. Like, the first case was kept under seal, so no one knew about it as they went mm-hmm. after Doug Williams. And his home, his office and home were raided in February of 2013. And I think they targeted me too, although I was never charged with any crime.
Do you stay out of the United States? You're in Holland.
That's right. I'm working in the Netherlands, but I travel regularly back to the United States.
Right. So, you haven't had any problems.
So, no, I've had no problems. But I've pretty solid reasons to think that I was similarly targeted in this operation. But in Doug Williams' case, so it was a similar thing. They sent undercover agents to go through his training, and the key to their legal theories seemed to be when he told the undercover agents that they should deny having received the training if they were asked about it. So the basic point of the operation was they wanted to shut down any teaching of polygraph countermeasures.
Which
Doug Williams
seems
was
to
indicted.
Indicate that it works, that the countermeasures
yes.
work.
Yeah, right. If they didn't work, the government wouldn't have gone through all the effort to target these people for entrapment and prosecution and imprisonment. So Doug Williams was, I attended his trial and have written about it on anthropolygraph.org. If anyone wants to know more details about that, you'll find them there. The sting operation undercover operation is called Operation Lie Busters. So if you search on that keyword, you'll find details about it.
Okay.
And so he was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison, which he served, and he's out now. But he's prohibited by the terms of his release from any polygraph-related activity for a period of 3 years, which I think is going to end in July of next year.
Okay, it'll be interesting if he gets back into it. Now, another thing on this this website that I found that you may be right, as was taken from an older article without attribution. Some truthful examinees have bought into Mashkey's claim that they need to employ his manipulations in order to ensure passage of their polygraph examination. These followers have suffered very unfortunate circumstances, for once court, they are normally eliminated from consideration for employment. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I haven't heard from anyone who says that they were caught using countermeasures that they learned from antipolygraph.org. So it's, I don't know what to say about that. I can say this, that no polygraph operator has ever demonstrated any ability to detect the sorts of countermeasures that I discussed with you and that are described in more detail in our book, The Lie Behind the Lie Detector, or in Doug Williams' manual, How to Sting the Polygraph. And in fact, the available peer-reviewed research shows that these sorts of countermeasures are not detectable.
Right.
And another converse argument to these such an argument against using countermeasures is that there's no evidence that not using countermeasures reduces your chances of being accused of using countermeasures. That is, just as the polygraph can't detect lies and you're at risk of randomly being accused of deception or lying, in the same way, there's a non-zero risk that anyone who takes a polygraph test will be accused of having tried to beat the test, even if they know nothing about it. That, in fact, was my experience in my public statement that I mentioned to you on antipolygraph.org. I described after my FBI experience, I was polygraphed by the Los Angeles Police Department, where I was serving as a volunteer reservist in an unpaid capacity. So I was asked to take a polygraph for that, and the polygraph operator accused me of using countermeasures, and he professed to be quite certain that he had caught me doing it. He wouldn't say what I was supposedly doing, but I certainly wasn't trying to beat the polygraph. And in fact, I knew nothing about polygraph countermeasures at all at the time. In fact, it was his false accusation that prompted me to research the matter.
Right. Well, another thing I read on that website seems to be contradictory to, they seem to be implying in this statement, these followers, that seems to imply that all this implies that all the truthful examinees who are using manipulations have all suffered the same consequence of getting caught and being eliminated. But they also said that previously, you know, we didn't know much about countermeasures, so now people need to be trained better. So that's admitting that at least in the past, countermeasures worked. And now they're saying, okay, now we've trained people on countermeasures, so there's less of a problem, but I'm not sure how you would prove that was the case. It also says new countermeasure sensors continue to be developed and fielded, which implies that they haven't reached the nirvana of detecting all countermeasures, or they wouldn't need to be developing, continually developing new training and sensors.
Well, that's true. I can tell you a little bit about the countermeasure.
okay, this is a bit like Spy versus Spy in Mad Magazine.
Yeah, it is. In Doug Williams' How to Sting the Polygraph manual, the primary technique that he recommended from the beginning was not mental countermeasures like I've described to you, but rather contracting one's anal sphincter muscle, which causes a spike in blood pressure. And it's easy to do and not observable. So one of the things that the polygraph operators have done to try to deal with this potential countermeasure is to put a pad on the seat of the polygraph chair, which measures changes in pressure. So if someone constricts their anal sphincter muscle, maybe it'll show some activity on that right. seat pad. And another effective countermeasure that was described in some of the polygraph research was to press your toes to the ground. You could do that in your shoe, and again, it's the tensing of the muscle, it's not visible, but that seat pad would presumably show a change in pressure over the seat if you press your toes to right. the floor. So there's that. There's the seat pad. Of course, the seat pad can't detect mental activity. Mm-hmm. And there's another technique that's been described in the literature and that we mentioned in the Lie Behind the Lie Detector, and still do, is to bite on the side of one's tongue hard enough to cause pain, but not so hard as to cause your tongue to bleed. And that's not observable either. But a headset has been developed that... You take the test, you wear this headset, and it purports to detect muscle movement in the jaw, which would potentially be associated with doing a tongue bite. So this they call it a masseter headset. I believe the Lafayette Instrument Company, the major polygraph vendor in the United States, developed this. It's not widely used, but it's something one might encounter. But again, the main technique that we recommend is mental countermeasures, and there's no device, countermeasure for reading one's mind to tell if you're counting, doing math in your head.
Counting backwards, yes. Can you refuse a polygraph? Like, under what circumstances can you refuse? Like, I presume in a criminal case, you can just refuse to take one.
Yeah, certainly in the common law systems of justice like you have in Canada and the United States, you have the right against self-incrimination and you don't have to talk to the police. So you could refuse a polygraph. And in fact, that's what I would recommend to anyone who's accused of crime is don't take the polygraph and don't talk to the police or investigators and get a lawyer and don't talk with investigators, without your lawyer present.
Right.
But employment, say, if you want to work with the RCMP or with the Canadian Intelligence Service.
Like CSIS or the CIA or FBI or whatever.
Right, with CSIS, you'll have to take the polygraph and, well, you can refuse it, but then you won't get hired with them. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'd recommend, too, for most people, is don't go to work for any employer that has the audacity to pretend to be able to read your mind with a lie detector. It's degrading, and I think it's not. It's a better option to look for employment with a more intelligent employer.
What is the 1988 Employee Polygraph Protection Act? Why was it created?
Okay, so that's a United States law. Mm-hmm. That was created to protect people who work for private employers from having to take a lie detector test to get hired or as a condition of continued employment. In the 1970s and especially in the 80s, lie detector testing became popular with retail employers, like mm-hmm. people who operated cash registers,
right.
as a way of trying to discourage and eliminate employee theft.
Mm-hmm.
And, it led to a lot of people being falsely accused of lying, of losing their jobs, over junk science. And also the asking of inappropriate questions. Some employers, they'd ask about people's sex lives and all sorts of inappropriate things.
Mm-hmm.
The law was passed with bipartisan support from both the Republican and Democratic parties in the United States. But there's a big exemption in the law. So whereas McDonald's or a supermarket can't require their employees to take lie detector tests, federal, state, and local government agencies can continue to demand lie detector tests from their applicants and employees. So it's a double standard that they set up with this law.
Yes, and I know you've asked to have the law tightened up so there are fewer exemptions. We're getting towards the end of our time. I'd just like to ask you, you know, has your work, the work of other people who don't believe in polygraphs, had any impact? Again, going back to this website, he said that membership in the American Polygraph Association has risen from 2043 to 28 to 20, and there's more organizations doing polygraphs and there's more polygraphs. I mean, are you losing this battle, or have there been successes in trying to reduce the use of polygraphs?
Well, we have had successes, and at this point, you know, lacking the money and resources to lobby Congress or the White House in this regard, our focus is on public education.
Mm-hmm.
And so lots of people are learning the truth about lie detectors and declining to take them. So I think we've had success in that respect. It's increasingly common knowledge that polygraphs are pseudoscience and not to be relied on. If you just do a Google search on polygraph, you'll find all sorts of information showing that they're not reliable.
And people can get your book, The Lie Behind the Lie Detector. It's a free online book on
yes.
your website, antipolygraph.org, right?
Right. It's available in PDF, EPUB, and Mobi or Amazon Kindle formats. And I'd encourage any listeners who are interested in learning more about lie detectors and their scientific shortcomings or how to pass or beat it to download the book. It's free. Again, we didn't start the site or write the book to make money, but as a public service.
Mm-hmm. Okay, are there any other things that you'd like to add to this discussion, important things that we haven't covered while talking about polygraphs?
Well, I think we've covered all the key points. Again, I'd encourage another area where unfortunately, and this is may account for some of the growth in polygraphs, they're being used on these tawdry television talk shows like Maury Povich or the Dr. Phil show. And they're used to raise suspense, especially during the Nielsen sweeps season. And it's always about something sexual. And
of course.
Yeah. And so oftentimes I'm contacted by people who say, well, my wife or husband or boyfriend or girlfriend thinks I've been cheating. They want me to take a lie detector test, and I feel I really have to now. And so what should I do? I think for any listeners who may have found themselves in a situation like that, you just need to understand that it's a really bad idea. The polygraph doesn't work at all. It's not like it's somewhat scientific. It just has a margin of error. No, it's a complete fraud. And I'd encourage them to educate themselves and not submit to it themselves or compel anyone else to do so.
Right. There's not much upside to taking it, because if somebody's suspicious of you and you refuse, they're probably still going to be suspicious. But if you take it and pass and they were suspicious, they're probably going to start thinking, oh, well, you beat the polygraph, right? And of course,
yeah,
if you take it and you fail,
how to beat the polygraph, they'll find out. Oh, it's
yeah.
that easy.
Yes. So, yeah, and if you fail the polygraph, of course, now they have ironclad proof that you were cheating on them. So it doesn't
right.
seem like there's much upside in taking it. But if you want to get into law enforcement or intelligence work in the United States or Canada, you're still countermeasures are your only way. If you don't believe in the polygraph, that would be the only way to get those jobs.
Well, I don't know that if countermeasures is the only way, but I think it would be imprudent not to use countermeasures, because it's the test has no scientific basis and a very high failure rate, at least in the United States, like among federal agencies, a 50% failure rate is common. And
really, you wouldn't
Yeah, about half of applicants who get as far as the polygraph fail it. With the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the polygraph failure rate is closer to 70%. And another thing, if you go in completely ignorant of polygraph policy or and procedure, and you just say, okay, I'm just going to breathe slowly and calmly, keep cool throughout it, you might get accused of using polygraph countermeasures because of breathing slower than they expect you to. And in the lie behind the lie detector, you learn about the sort of breathing rate that they expect you to have and know at least how to avoid pitfalls that could lead you to being accused of having tried to beat the test when you did no such thing.
Yeah, and that's kind of a reasonable thing. I mean, some people, say, in a job interview, know that they're going to be really uptight and stressed, and so they'll do deep breathing, they'll try to calm themselves down, they'll talk to themselves, like, listen to every question, respond. And so their actual behavior in an interview is completely different than when they're out for lunch with their friends, when they might be quite vivacious and stuff. And that could be taken as they're hiding something, but actually they just don't want to screw it up again because last time they started stumbling over their words or whatever. So I could see people taking very different approaches to lie detectors. Some people just not even thinking about it, and other people saying, oh my God, like, I can't afford to lose this, so I'm going to change my behavior to ensure that I pass.
Right. So for that reason, I think for anyone who feels compelled to go through with the polygraph, it's prudent to educate oneself about the procedure, about the available countermeasures, and whether you choose to use countermeasures or not, to know the pitfalls to avoid, like slow breathing.
Well, George, I'd just like to thank you for joining us today, and I've certainly learned a lot about the polygraph that I didn't know before. Maybe I'll get contacted by somebody from the other side who can defend the polygraph against charges that it's pseudoscience.
Well, perhaps. If so, I'd be very interested to listen.
Okay. Thanks, George. Appreciate
it. Okay, thank you, David.
Okay, goodbye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 207 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.curl@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth, commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.